I'm Matt Bush. For BPR News, I'm speaking with Stephen Nash, author of the book Reconstruction's Ragged Edge. So we'll start. I think maybe a way to first start about this is talking about North Carolina in the Civil War joining the Confederacy. It was not a clear-cut choice for the state as it was for many other southern states, and I think that's maybe a way to start this conversation. What was North Carolina's kind of position going into the Civil War?
North Carolina was one of the last states to secede from the Union. Like many of the Upper South states, North Carolina took sort of a wait-and-see approach in the aftermath of Lincoln's election, whereas the Deep South cotton states largely seceded in quick order before Lincoln even took the oath of office. North Carolina and many of the other sort of Upper South states waited to see what he was going to do as president. The line in the sand, so to speak, was any effort to coerce, in their mind, the seceded southern states back into the Union. So when Lincoln called for volunteers after the bombardment of Fort Sumter to put down the Southern Rebellion, that's where many North Carolinians decided that the time had come. They had to choose between their state, their region, and the Union. And many of them, even former sort of quote-unquote conditional Unionists like Zebulon Vance, chose to go with their state and join the Confederacy.
And there's even a sort of difference between the mountains of Western North Carolina, the people here, and the rest of North Carolina on this issue too, correct?
Right, yeah. Western North Carolina was probably the most, or one of the most divided. And there's also sort of a section in the Piedmont, the so-called Quaker Belt, that was very divided. But in Western North Carolina, you have a sort of strong contingent of Unionists, sort of folks who remained committed to the Union even through the duration of the war. And that's only going to be exacerbated as the war goes along. Confederate policies, taxes that sort of confiscated people's property in lieu of actual paying cash, the impressment of property, the draft was a significant choice by the Confederacy that alienated a lot of Western North Carolinians. Those sorts of things all strained loyalty to the Confederacy in this region. So Western North Carolina was sort of reluctant. Well, there was a segment of Western North Carolina that was reluctant, really, in the majority, most were pro-Confederacy in 1861, but that strains over time. They sort of become disaffected and disillusioned, and hence a major site of guerrilla violence. And
Zebulon Vance came from this area and was governor of North Carolina during the Civil War. So talk about what his tenure as governor was like.
Vance as governor did his best to essentially balance the interests of the state and the interests of the Confederacy. And that was no easy thing. You know, he has this relatively famous quote where he says later in the war that the great heart of the people were never in this contest, that, you know, the great will or the great heart of the people were never committed to the Confederacy. And there's sort of a double-edged sword to that, because on the one hand, here's this guy who famously claimed that in 1861 he was in the middle of giving this really strong pro-Union speech, and then word comes in that Fort Sumter had been fired upon. He says that his arm dropped slowly and sadly by the side of a secessionist, that he sort of had this late change of heart. For all of that talk about Unionism and sort of resistance to secession, during the war he takes an incredibly strong stance to help to keep the state within the Confederacy. He often has this reputation as being oppositionist to Jefferson Davis and sort of resisting and protecting the people's civil liberties. And certainly he defends the state Supreme Court when they choose to protect the interests of the people, particularly regarding the draft. But he also convened special state courts. He sent troops out to try to hunt down guerrillas and deserters. So he also takes this sort of strong measure to suppress dissent in the state. So on the one hand, you have this guy who's saying, well, the great will of the people were never really in this contest, who's backing up the state Supreme Court. On the other hand, he's also using sort of state apparatus to try to crack down dissent and hold the state within the Confederacy.
His history with slaves, slave owner, parent came from a slave owning family right outside of Asheville. So talk about his history of owning slaves.
Zeb was never one of the largest slave owners in the region. I believe his father or grandfather at one point was one of them. I believe around 1800, father maybe was one of the three largest slaveholders in the region. Around the time that Zeb was born, I believe his father had about 17 slaves, which doesn't technically sort of put him in the planter class, according to most historians, but that's kind of a relative scale, because in Western North Carolina, particularly where he was born out towards Weaverville in the Reams Creek area, not a lot of slaves in that area. So to own 17 slaves, and his father operated a series of drover stands for people driving their livestock to market, to have 17 slaves and that sort of livelihood certainly put the Vance family at the time of Zeb's birth sort of up there towards the regional elite. His father dies when he's young, so Zeb's family goes through a series of hardships when he's still young. But he himself, by 1860, is, I believe, going to own 6 slaves of various ages. So he was reared from a slaveholding family, certainly one that had a history of wealth, political prestige, and status. And by 1860, he's sort of continuing that on as a lawyer.
What was his stance on slavery? As was he someone who would have freed his slaves, as we hear a lot of people at their death, or was it something he saw it as an institution the South needed to continue? What was his stance on slavery?
Vance on slavery is not an enlightened individual. He's not somebody who believed that the institution needed to go away. His father, I believe, included some provisions in his will to sort of protect certain members of the family and put some of the family slaves on the path towards emancipation, but Zeb was not of that ilk. And that is pretty typical, really, you know, in the sort of generation coming up to about the 1830, the mid-1830s, there's still this sort of ambivalence that slavery was a necessary evil. They were sort of uncomfortable about it. Zeb's generation sort of goes the other way. That's when the hardening sectional tensions develop with the North, and the economy of the slave cotton belt and slaveholding deep South really sort of intensifies. So Zeb's generation, and Zeb was not particularly of an introspective nature in slavery. He was not necessarily somebody who believed that the institution needed to go away. And certainly after the war, race is going to play a central part of his politics. So he doesn't really sort of transcend that in any way.
Civil War ends in 1865. His term as governor ends. What does he do after the Civil War?
The end of the Civil War was a tough period for Zeb. He was a deeply ambitious individual, and politics was basically his lifeblood. He was a lawyer, but politics was his thing. That's what he loved to do. That's where he sort of defined himself. And as a former Confederate, he was arrested and sent to prison in Washington, D.C. for the short term after the war. And then he's essentially sent home, pardoned, but disfranchised. He's not able to participate in politics. And he can't hold office again until the 1870s. So unable to hold office and deeply ambitious, he desperately wanted to be a United States senator, was not eligible to be a United States senator. So he pours himself into the campaigns of the aftermath of the war. He's, by all accounts, was a tremendously effective stump speaker. Was very good at sort of going before large crowds, telling jokes, sort of storytelling and moving the audience. So he did that and played a role behind the scenes, helped organize the campaigns. According to historian Gordon McKinney, Vance was one of the architects of the sort of white supremacist racial campaign, the Democratic Conservative Party campaign in the 1860s, 67, 68, and later, that really sort of pushes the politics to try to break apart the biracial Republican coalition in the state in Western North Carolina.
This is the time of Reconstruction. So we'll start very broadly, and you can go as long as you want on this answer. But what was Reconstruction? What was sort of the goal of Republicans who were in power of the government at that time? And how did it go off the rails?
Reconstruction essentially is about two things. The national level, it's essentially about two things. It's about restoring the Union, which sounds simple, right? And essentially take the seceded states and figure out a way to bring them back in. Lincoln, Andrew Johnson wanted to do that as quickly and sort of painlessly as possible, whereas radical Republicans like Thaddeus Stevens, Charles Sumner, and others essentially argued that the former Confederate states should be returned to territorial status and essentially have to go through a series of, well, Reconstruction in order to be allowed back into the Union. So on the one hand, it's about restoring the Union, of which there are deep divisions about what that actually should include. And in the other part, it was about African-American political, civil, social rights. And again, the federal government has a really sort of difficult time crafting a real sort of clear policy. They demobilized the military quickly. They scale down Union forces rapidly. So there isn't really a strong direct federal presence in many of the Confederate states. And Johnson's policy gave a lot of white Southerners, including former Confederates, this idea that they were going to play a role in Reconstruction. And that really kind of backfires because in the 1865 elections in which they're electing their first representatives back to the United States Congress, many former Confederate states sent former Confederates. Most notably, Alexander Stevens, the vice president of the Confederacy, was elected to the House of Representatives from Georgia. And Congress sort of draws a line in the sand and says, you know, look, we're not gonna seat these people. And thus sort of begins the battle between Congress and Johnson. Johnson wanting this sort of lenient restoration policy, Congress wanting to make the South adjust, make some sort of at least substantial change. Things come out of that, like the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, Abandoned Lands, popularly known as the Freedmen's Bureau, which comes into the South to help with the adjustment to the end of slavery, to help supervise labor contracts, monitor civil courts, make sure that equal justice is being handed out. And there's a lot of resistance and struggle over that. And I mean, if you take people at their time, both sides, in essence, felt like they were struggling for the idea of representative government. Lower class whites, disaffected unionists, African Americans, who in some ways had been dominated politically. African Americans, clear political domination. They had no political rights under slavery. Lower class whites and others who essentially watched as an overwhelming majority of their political leaders were of the slaveholding class, who now see this as an opportunity where they can play a role. And it really sort of becomes a struggle between these different groups. And meanwhile, the conservative Democrats, who had always sort of been in power, and they're watching things like federal civil rights acts be passed. They're watching the military play an increasing role. And certainly after March of 1867, when you have the Reconstruction Acts, where Congress sort of seizes control over Reconstruction and returns many of the former Confederate states to a military district with a military general in command, they believe that they were being denied a representative form of government, that they were not being allowed to play a role in their affairs. And of course, they argued that they were, quote unquote, the best men, the leaders, the elite, the ones who should be leading. So all of that, right, leads to this significant clash over the meaning of government, the meaning of democracy. And in 1867, 68, when Congress sort of gets involved, you see the scales shift towards the lower class, towards the unionists, and certainly towards African Americans. And that's going to build a strong Republican base across the South. And certainly in North Carolina and Western North Carolina, you're going to have this strong Republican base emerge. And it turns out that the only way that that could really be stopped in the South during Reconstruction was through violence. The emergence of groups like the Ku Klux Klan and others who will beat, torture, and intimidate in order to regain control and, quote unquote, redeem the South. Essentially, between 1870 through 1876, you have this sort of wave of redemption and violence that is going to lead towards what many sort of call the failure of Reconstruction, the collapse of Reconstruction.
We'll get back to the failure of Reconstruction in a moment, but what was Zebulon Vance doing during this time?
Vance, as I said, was sort of barred from formal politics. He could not hold office in the immediate aftermath of the war. He relocates from Western North Carolina. He does not stay in his native region. He relocates to Statesville. He'll go back to practicing law, but also politically involved behind the scenes in strategy. He certainly is still seen as sort of the preeminent conservative Democrat, even if he can't hold office. So he's certainly still engaged politically, crafting strategy, giving speeches. He's going to come back in the 1870s. Formally, he'll come back in the 1870s. He desperately wanted to be a United States senator. That's not going to work out. So in 1876, he comes back and runs as governor and has a very sort of statewide famous campaign against a former Unionist Republican by the name of Thomas Settle. And he and Settle in 1876 have what's called, quote unquote, the Battle of Giants. And Vance wins in a rather significant election. And at that point, he sort of turns his attention back towards state politics, particularly railroad building. He's going to be a key player in the completion of the Western North Carolina Railroad to Asheville. But really, he's at that point scheming towards getting to the United States Senate. And he'll be appointed to the U.S. Senate in 1878, and he'll serve there until the time of his death in the 1890s. So Vance, there's no denying that Vance is sort of the political figure of the state during this region or during this time. He looms larger than anybody. And for a while, he's sort of working the circuit, you know, shifting and trying to win hearts and minds of particularly whites who had gone over to the Republicans, try to bring them back in the defense of their race and the defense of their people and their region against what they deemed an outside illegitimate force in the Republican Party. And then once he becomes governor and sort of works towards the construction of the railroad, he goes off to the United States Senate. And really, his service in the Senate is largely symbolic. There isn't really a great, as far as I can tell, a great legislative legacy that bears Zebulon Vance's name. He was largely seen as, many politicians before him and after were sort of seen as a spokesperson of the South. So he was largely symbolic. He was seen as a leader, even if he didn't necessarily accomplish anything in a sort of tangible legislative way. And he has an almost epic fall from grace in the 1890s when you have this sort of resurgent biracial populism coming in, particularly in North Carolina, where, again, sort of two parties remain pretty viable and the Republicans align with the populists. And Vance tried to take a stand on the sub-treasury plan, which was this populist idea about warehouses and storing crops until better prices, essentially collective action on the part of producers. And Vance opposed it, and he almost lost his reelection and then dies shortly thereafter. So he sort of becomes, again, the sort of great governor of the South, the spokesperson of the South in death. But his political career almost came to a very abrupt end in his mind.
What was his role in the failure of Reconstruction?
Statewide, he's significant. Regionally, again, he sort of moves out of Western North Carolina and sort of, but certainly he's the guy in terms of the Democratic Conservative Party. He's their biggest figure. And he's in many ways the architect of the campaign, the politics, the rhetoric of white man's party, defense of the white race that is going to be so important to the redemption of North Carolina. But I think it's telling and it's significant that even left to just the rhetoric, if it was just a campaign of, you know, white men rally to your race and defend yourself and defend your state and homes, that didn't work. In and of itself, that did not topple the Republicans. The Republicans sweep the state in 1868. They enact a constitution that has tremendous democratic reforms and protections for education and other sorts of things. That's still the constitution that is on the books in North Carolina to this day. So Reconstruction's legacy is still very much there in terms of present-day North Carolina. So Vance and the conservative Democrats couldn't topple it just in that. It's only when it was coupled with the extra-legal violence that sweeps the state. You have a famous lynching of an African-American Republican leader in Alamance County, a man by the name of Wyatt Outlaw, who's dragged out in the middle of the night by Klansmen, lynched in the town square, and his body left hanging as a sort of symbol of what will happen to Republicans. You have a white Republican leader by the name of John Stevens, who is executed and lured into the bottom of a courthouse and stabbed multiple times and left to bleed to death over the course of the night. That led Republican Governor William Holden to suspend and declare martial law in the counties of Granville and Alamance. That leads to the so-called Kirk Holden War, in which a lot of Western North Carolina Unionists sort of rally to their old cause and their old commander and come to fight the Ku Klux Klan in these two counties. And a Klan leader in the state legislature helped to get impeachment charges filed against Holden for exceeding his authority, which he did. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which the Constitution of the state says you cannot do, a legacy of the Civil War, where they said that you could not do it then either. And Holden's impeached, largely on the party actions of the Democrats and with the help of the Klan. And that really sort of pushes the state back into the conservative hands. They had recaptured the state legislature in 1872, start pushing for a new constitution, start undoing a lot of the local reforms that had sort of been put in place. So there's a lot of things that are going on at this time. And Vance is very much in the organizational point. He's very much a sort of leader of this. He's very much involved in the rhetoric. I've never seen any evidence that directly connects Vance as a leader, so to speak, of the Ku Klux Klan, but he certainly encouraged its activities in the sense of the rhetoric and the sort of, you know, vitriol that was placed on the Republican government of the state.
You mentioned a lot of this seems to be his rhetoric was what he was known for. What about his rhetoric was so, I guess, impressive in the during that time period? And how did it, as you were saying, how did it really impact people who did then act?
Vance was incredibly politically savvy. He was from Western North Carolina and always sort of played that card, even though most of his career he's sort of no longer in Western North Carolina. He sort of moves to Statesville and, you know, Raleigh and then off to D.C. So because he was from this region, he always was able to sort of play a more homely, a more sort of I'm one of the people. In fact, a lot of people sort of said that that was his great touch, that he was sort of seen as the man of the people, that he was sort of the spokesperson for this sort of broad, multi-class, white population. And he could play to that, and he played to it quite a bit. He was quick-witted. He was sarcastic. He would have no problem fitting in today's politics of 140 characters on Twitter. He could take somebody down pretty quickly. He had a way of relating to people. One of the first sort of research letters that I ever read from Zebulon Vance was from a lower class white during the Civil War. And you could tell because the handwriting and the sort of, you know, spellings and things were kind of off. And the person who wrote to him said, or addressed it to the governor in Raleigh, R-A-W-L-E-Y. And when Vance wrote back, sure enough, governor's mansion, Raleigh, R-A-W-L-E-Y. Right, he always sort of was able to sort of connect and figure out a way. And there's you know, stories of his sort of wit, many of which are apocryphal. This one probably is apocryphal, but it's sort of symptomatic, and I like it. But supposedly he was giving a speech once, and somebody had put a portrait of Robert E. Lee in the outhouse, and asked Vance what he thought of it, and Vance said that he thought it was appropriate because nobody could scare the dung out of a Yankee like Robert E. Lee. And that is Vance, right? That's, even if he didn't say that, that's the sort of thing that he was known for. He could be incredibly shrewd, and he could be incredibly folksy all at the same time. And in a way, I've always sort of viewed that as a sort of parallel to someone like Lincoln, who also could sort of play this sort of prairie folksy, let me tell you a story in order to convey a larger point. I don't think Vance was necessarily on Lincoln's level, but he always had, and I'd say in some cases he could be a lot more crass than Lincoln, although Lincoln had a tendency sometimes to be a little less than polite. But he had that way of sort of connecting with people. And in during Reconstruction, that takes a very hard racial turn. There's a press report of a speech that he gave in Rutherfordton, and I don't have the full text of the speech, but a description of it. And what it was is he created this sort of fictional black militia captain, supposedly commanding the county militia in Rutherfordton, and of course goes into great exaggerated stereotypical detail of what this figure would look like, and then placed all the leading white Republicans of the county behind this individual, as if they were all taking orders and marching behind this sort of over-the-top stereotypical black man. And of course that was designed to basically shame the white men of Rutherfordton. How could any of you do that? And one of the people reporting on that said that it electrified the crowd and supposedly drew Republican defectors away. So that's what Vance was capable of. That's what he could do.
What led to the monument being built here in Asheville, and why was it built?
In some cases, I've often said that Zeb Vance is the enigmatic face of the Civil War in North Carolina. He's remains probably the most popular figure of that period across the state. And I think a lot of that has to do in some ways that North Carolina has often been the subject of jokes amongst other former Confederate states about desertion. And, you know, a lot of people, I used to work for the park in the National Park Service, Civil War Battlefield Park. And people would often say, well, you know, that North Carolina license plate is first in flight because Civil War North Carolina soldiers ran more than any other, which isn't true. But there's certainly a sort of idea amongst North Carolinians that compared to Virginia, they were often slighted and they weren't given credit for what they accomplished, the charge at Gettysburg being a prime example. And Vance was their Robert E. Lee. He was the ultimate guns and butter politician who defended the people's liberties at home, stood up against centralized power in the form of the Confederate government, conducted blockade runners on the part of the state to support the troops, and was doing all these things to keep the state moving forward and fighting for the Confederacy. So Vance was, in many ways, the sort of beau ideal Southern state politician. And many people surmise that had the Confederacy survived another 2 years and Jefferson Davis, of course, couldn't run for re-election, that Vance would have been one of the logical next men up, so to speak. So he looms large. He was the war governor of the South. And as such, his sort of political reputation and fame was always very, very important to the state. He was always sort of central to the state. And he played an active role in creating that image. His supporters played an active role in creating that image, that here was this guy who in some ways was the quintessential Confederate. After the war, when you have the principle of states' rights sort of elevated above all else as the cause of the war, you know, that the Civil War was not about slavery, it was about states' rights. If that's the case, then Zeb Vance is the quintessential Confederate politician. He placed the role of the state and the rights of its citizens above centralization and was effective at it. So there's sort of the core of his appeal, actively cultivated, defended by Vance and his supporters. So when he dies in the 1890s, there is almost this immediate push that there has to be something done to commemorate him, and particularly they wanted it to be in his native Buncombe County. He's, of course, buried in Riverside Cemetery. So there's this memorial association that starts up pretty quickly in the wake of his death that goes around collecting money. And they decide to build this obelisk monument to Vance that will sit in what is now Pack Square and sort of be the sort of commemoration of the great son of Buncombe County and the war governor of the South.
The move now is to either rename the monument or to contextualize it. What are your thoughts on that? And what is missing from it that in current day United States history 2017 needs to be there?
It's a great question, and certainly not one with an easy answer. The thing about monuments and history and memory is there's so many different ways of looking at something. And certainly to people who have ancestors tied to the Confederacy or whatnot, Vance is very important to them. He's from this region. He's a major player in state and national politics, so therefore he has a certain appeal. But a lot of Vance's legacy and career are not, in our contemporary time, really worthy of celebration. Here's a guy who really pushed a racial discriminatory rhetoric and policy during Reconstruction. He really bears a lot of credit for the conservative democratic redemption pushback against Reconstruction, which was a sort of lost opportunity for democracy in the country. So the obelisk, the monument, on one hand, is this moment in time. It's the 1890s, which in and of itself is an absolute mess in terms of state politics. You have this biracial populist movement. You have this crackdown coming from the Democrats, who are going to ultimately, in around 1900, lead towards disenfranchisement of many, many African Americans, but also many poor whites. It wasn't just African Americans who were cut out, although they were the primary target, but a lot of the lower class whites who fed into that populist movement were cut out in state disfranchisement. So in many ways, this memorial is to a Confederate who died a U.S. senator, which is often overlooked, and was erected during this time of sort of renewed biracial political conflict. And Vance sort of fit comfortably in there, because then they're able to sort of take the Civil War Reconstruction memory and play that up again as a way of trying to pull whites back from this sort of class-based challenge that the populace represented. So the monument, in one way, was an effort to overcome that. It was a way of trying to recoalesce people. It was a way of trying to honor the sort of idea of the Confederacy and Vance's contribution to it. So on one hand, the context of the 1890s is missing, right? He died a U.S. senator. That was the position that he always really wanted. That element is kind of downplayed. The populist component is downplayed. The location of the monument is downplayed. This is the same town square that in 1868 saw African Americans gunned down trying to vote. That's hidden behind this one monument to this one guy in this public space. In 2017, what's seriously lacking, and what I think was sort of the great missed opportunity, is just last summer in 2016, they held a rededication to the monument. They should have, I think, added either another plaque onto the monument, interpretive markers around the monument that contextualize Vance and his ideas and his attitudes and his legacy in all of its time, not just the Civil War, but also into the 1880s, 1890s, his political career, broadly speaking. But the other thing that strikes me is that while there's a plaque on it that talks about Zebulon Vance, the monument itself just says Vance. That's what's carved into the monument. Add other plaques. Talk about other members of the Vance family. Talk about his brother Robert, who was also a Confederate general, who also had ideas similar to his brother, who had a long-standing post-war political career. But talk about the African Americans of the Vance family. Talk about the fact that these were brothers who in 1860 owned collectively around 15, 16 or so slaves, who play a significant role in Reconstruction and its aftermath, and tell the story as well of the African Americans of the Vance family. Tell the story of their efforts to secure their lives, their livelihoods, their freedom in the aftermath of the war. Make it a sort of more broadly inclusive Vance monument, but then also contextualize it and say that, you know, Vance represents something that in some ways we should all be glad that we have overcome. We should all be striving to move beyond that. Monuments in and of themselves can be representative of a complicated past. They can be celebratory, which is often what makes them controversial. But they're also reminders of what we evolve into, how we change as a society, and in some cases, what we overcome. I like to believe that we've overcome a lot of Zebulon Vance's less savory points. Reflect that on the monument. I believe you can contextualize that monument. I believe you can put more around it. I mean, it is a monument that, for God's sakes, just a couple feet away has statues of pigs and things marching to market. Put more stuff up there that really sort of reflects that, on one hand, this is who he was, but these are these other individuals associated with him, and their stories are every bit as significant to what Asheville and Buncombe County are now, as opposed to what they were in the 1860s or 1890s.
Final two questions. One, from what you were saying earlier, the Lost Cause treated, the Lost Cause movement treated Vance pretty well. Talk about the Lost Cause today. We see these sort of ebbs and flows with it, where it becomes, it sort of resurges and then it fades away again and all that. Talk about the Lost Cause in 2017.
Well, the Lost Cause in and of itself, of course, has a long history. It's essentially the effort to reshape the Confederate cause and redefine the Confederate cause. The Confederate and Southern people who lived through that time were pretty clear that they understood what the major differences were between the North and South. And almost all of them emanated from the institution of slavery. And of course, the Confederate vice president famously says in a speech in 1861 that the great cornerstone of this Confederacy is the idea that African Americans and whites are not equal. After the war, states' rights becomes a sort of new idea that this was about constitutional principles. That legacy, Vance played a pretty significant role in pushing, although I found that Vance in some ways complicated it. I think there was sort of a North Carolina strand of this, and Vance becomes a sort of central figure because Vance represents this sort of states' rights policy, and this sort of states' rights politics in which he stood up against Jefferson Davis and protected the interests. Of course, there's a biography written by Glenn Tucker and Zeb Vance, Champion of Personal Freedom. So he sort of creates and has this image created around him that in some ways makes Vance and North Carolina like the most Confederate of the Confederate states. If states' rights are really what it's about, well, then North Carolina and Vance did it better than anybody else. I think that strain really sort of continues to resonate across the state. Of course, we have Vance Monument in Raleigh. We have the Vance Monument here. We have Vance's statues in the House of Representatives, I believe. So he really is sort of continuously put forward as sort of the face of the North Carolina Civil War experience. And as such, he really sort of has this, like, well, look at all the great things that North Carolina did to protect individual freedom that completely overshadows slavery, completely overshadows all the other sort of stuff. That continues to resonate. I think you can see resonance for the Lost Cause and how it sort of influences politics in that sense, right? Because certain people and certain groups will go back and try to say, well, here's again the sort of movement about constitutionalism and constitutional issues. And you see this sort of political push to say, well, we need to get back to a sort of better understanding and a limited government, a better understanding of the Constitution. I think the Lost Cause plays into that. It's in some ways reinforcing, it gives historical legitimacy to it. It's a false interpretation of what happened. It's a memory, but memories that are politically powerful and useful and thus is able to continuously inform politics to this day. I don't think it's going away. It does sort of ebb and flow. As somebody who teaches, I'm continuously sort of heartened by the vast majority of my students who see the complexity in the period and always sort of gives me hope that people can handle complexity. I do firmly believe that. We can contextualize the Vance Monument. We can contextualize the Confederacy and Reconstruction, the Lost Cause, and make it explainable to people today. But it's still definitely out there, and it's still very much a part of it. And, you know, it's not going to go away.
All right, and the last question, we talked about this a bit earlier, but to go into it full. The failure of Reconstruction, how is that still felt in the South today?
Well, you know, in some ways, it's It's an interesting question as to whether or not Reconstruction failed. Certainly, if you're looking at it in a sense of did it accomplish what we hope it would have accomplished, it certainly fails. But very rarely in world history can you find a country that abolishes slavery, however it abolishes slavery, and then relatively quickly extends civil rights and political rights to the former slaves. So the United States did something kind of unique, and then sort of, as appears to be sometimes the case, sort of grew tired of how hard it was going to be to sort of protect that. And that's where the sort of failure comes along, which is the federal government pulls back and sort of, you know, says, okay, well, you're on your own, figure it out. The legacies of Reconstruction, sadly, I think, become more and more relevant every day. The political violence, the rhetoric, the emotionalism, the idea that you're sort of locked in this life and death struggle over the meaning of the republic. I often tell my students that I used to believe that the rhetoric that the republic is in danger had gone away, but it continuously comes back every generation, it seems. And certainly I feel like there's a lot of rhetoric now that we believe as if the republic is somehow in great danger. That's relevant. The voter suppression issue, the violence of politics. Giving this interview today, the day after a United States congressman and others were shot, the violence of politics, the heightened emotionalism, that's very much a legacy of Reconstruction. The racial tinge to politics is very much still there. And in some ways, building off of the violence and racial tinge, the struggle to get at a sort of central agreeable truth. Elaine France Parsons has written a book on the Ku Klux Klan now that really lays bare that one of the real tragedies that that organization, secret organization, sort of creates is this idea that they problematize their existence to the point where you have people north and south who are actively writing and saying that this thing just doesn't exist. That these men and women and children across the South, of which we have thousands of pages of federal testimony that are published, available online, look it up, Google it, the investigation into the affairs in the late insurrectionary states, thousands of pages of testimony from across the South of violence, torture, intimidation. And yet we have these people in North Carolina, nationally in the North, who actively work to say, yeah, that's not actually happening. It's not real. That is people essentially injuring themselves or otherwise creating stories for political capital. So in other words, you have people like in Western North Carolina, James Justice, who is a white Republican who was attacked in Rutherford County, Aaron Biggerstaff, who was a white Republican who was attacked in Rutherford County, George Brooks, who is an African-American who was attacked in Buncombe County. You have other African-Americans who are beaten, stoned, and otherwise intimidated. And you have men who are shot on Pack Square, a shooting during the election in 1868 that is attributed to the Ku Klux Klan. And yet you have this active campaign to say, well, that's not actually real. It's the original sort of sense of misinformation and misdirection. And that certainly seems to be at play in our current politics, that we can't even come together across party lines to agree upon, well, there's a certain set of facts of violence and intimidation going on, and we have to deal with it. As I once heard a historian by the name of Stephen Hahn point out, we like to think of Reconstruction as a crime, as an anomaly, as something that isn't representative of American politics. But what if it's the norm? What if Reconstruction is actually more of what our politics is like? What if it is racially infused structurally? What if it is, in fact, violent and prone to emotionalism and rhetoric? And what if it is, in fact, prone to misdirection and misinformation? Then what do we take to it to this day, and how do we overcome that?
I'm Matt Bush. I've been speaking with author Stephen Nash.